54. Flick. Flick rubbed the back of her hand across her swollen lips. She buzzed from head to toe, and her skin felt tight. Some sort of adrenaline roared through her, akin to the way she felt when he'd spoken her name. The name I made for myself. The name she had chosen after she'd left her home behind. The name that fit her the way the grit and grime of white roaring did. When Jin's breath skated her neck, she hadn't been thinking of the consequences. She wasn't worried about what her mother or anyone else might think. Jin had never expected her to be more than what she was. She didn't know if her mother truly did seek to repair her name, or if she was still in league with the Ram, but what Flick did know was that she was done with Lady Linden. Done vying for a love that didn't exist. Arthi was right. She had been lost, but she had finally found her way. She might be stumbling along it right now because she had never been kissed before, and she certainly hadn't thought she'd ever kiss Jin Casimir, but she had found it nonetheless. The press was slowly crowding the hall. Matteo had gathered quite the extensive list. Flick recognised badges from almost every one of the papers in White Roaring, despite the late hour. "I don't think I've ever seen so many news folks in one place before," Jin commented, his voice slightly hoarse. It gave Flick a little thrill, even if she couldn't look at him without imagining his mouth on hers. Focus. They had a job to do. And once the Ram arrived, as well as her mother, they needed to be on full alert. Flick made the rounds as Arthi had instructed, picking up bits of conversation as she passed. "What is this damning document we've been promised?
I didn't know Arthi Casimir was involved. This could be scandalous.
Are we even to believe anything we hear?" Flick's heart sped up any time she saw the ledger in Arthi's hands. In many ways, that violet-ribboned book made Arthi the most powerful person in Atenia, because with it, she controlled a Ram. But it was their one piece of evidence, their one and only recourse in this country that had taken so much from them. She stopped to pick up a glass of water, hoping that would settle her nerves a bit. When she set her glass down, something brushed against her leg, feather-light like an insect that might have slipped inside the hall.
"Oh, you're no fly, are you?" she crooned.
It was Laith's kitten, fluffy tail swishing back and forth like a duster, that motor of a purr starting up again when Flick crouched.
"We really ought to give you a name, something like Snowflake or Alabaster."
Those were white, but neither sounded like a name fit for a kitten. She'd never had a pet before.
"Cloud, maybe. You are very floofy. Or Snow, or even Opal for how regal you are."
"Stop distracting yourself," Flick chided. She looked around the hall. If the kitten was here, Laith was bound to be close. Strange. Arthi had made it seem as if she had severed ties with the High Captain. Had she changed her mind and invited him here? Flick picked up the kitten and took her over to where Jin was waiting by one of the round tables, piled high with refreshments, where they were to be stationed. He seemed just as confused by the sight of the kitten as she was. Arthi snapped her pocket watch closed, drawing Flick and Jin's attention. She nodded. At a poised knock, Matteo pulled open the double doors at the end of the hall, and Flick felt each beat of her heart like a smithy's hammer in her ears. Jin reached for her hand and squeezed.
"Stick to the plan. No matter what happens, we protect the ledger."
Flick nodded. The kitten wriggled free and darted under the tablecloth to hide. Flick wished she could join her. The Ram swept into the hall, wearing a cloak as deeply blue as the sea. The guests exclaimed in surprise, voices stirring to a hum. Every bulb in the chandelier lit a different facet of that nefarious mask, horns curling from the antique bronze like those of the devil. Only the Ram's eyes were visible, bright and cerulean. Flick's heart stopped. She could barely gasp. She stumbled back.
Jin was asking her what was wrong, but she couldn't hear him. The room faded, the buzz of the press's excited voices winnowing away. And Flick had a single harrowing thought. She always did think her mother had remarkable eyes. 55. Arthi. In the hushed silence of the ram's entrance, Arthi heard Flick's gasp, and then the single word she whispered, ringing as loud as the crack of a whip. Mother. It took Arthi a moment to understand that Flick wasn't looking at her mother, but the ram. Lady Lyndon was the ram. That was when Arthi knew her plan had gone horribly wrong. Because the ram didn't know about the press. Lady Lyndon did. The ram was supposed to be ambushed, but Lady Lyndon knew what was really going to happen. They had no element of surprise on their side. They told her exactly what they'd be doing here, and she had come prepared. The ram knew they had learned the truth about the ledger and the vampires since Flick had first visited her mother. Arthi's plan had failed.
Do not blame yourself. There's still nothing she can do,
Penn said at Arthi's side.
The press will report any and all of it.
This wasn't a frightened official or some flustered lord. This was the ram. Arthi shook her head.
Not if they're dead.
There were four sets of doors in the Ethereum's meeting hall. Four escape points.
Get to the doors! She yelled over the hushed whispers. Everyone out!
But she should have known it was futile. This was the ram. Not only the ruler of Atenia, but the embodiment of everything Arthi hated. She was head of the East Jevent Company that had raided her homeland. The woman who had taken her humanity. The tyrant who had struck the match that destroyed Spindrift.
Get ready, Arthi told Jin and the others.
The doors flung open before anyone could reach them. Men flooded inside, dressed from head to toe in black, masks pulled over their faces. They weren't from the Horn Guard, but they were armed, to the teeth. The Ethereum Hall, with its luxurious decadence, erupted in outright chaos. Knives flashed in the brilliant light of the chandeliers. People screamed, fell. Blood spattered and pooled on the alabaster tiles. It was a massacre.
The ram doesn't intend for anyone to leave the hall alive,
Arthi shouted. Matteo looked sick to his stomach, but stepped in to defend a trio of women, narrowly missing a machete that swung straight for his arm. Jin was using his umbrella off to her right, and to her left, Penn was lifting his arms, and it took Arthi a moment to realize his power. The ram's men screamed, some trying to fling away invisible parasites, others curling into balls. Arthi had known Penn was powerful, but seeing the way he brought those men to their knees with nothing but a wave of his hands made her feel a little afraid herself. She needed to help them. She spotted Flick in the fray and shoved the ledger into her hands.
Protect it!
Flick was barely breathing.
Flick! Now is not the time. We've come this far. You've come this far.
Right. Yes, Flick whispered. She held it tight. Arthi ran and helped someone to their feet. She picked up a waiter's tray and slammed it against one of the ram's men, plucking his knife and stabbing him through the throat. He fell with a gurgle. There were too many fallen reporters. But with Penn's help, they could turn this around.
You see, Arthi? A voice asked from behind her.
Arthi felt the blood in her veins go cold.
Laith, people in power will never care for those like us.
He sounded detached, far off. He spoke of the ram killing her own people. He spoke of the Hylia the ram had promised him, the one he was inching toward Arthi to steal.
No, she said, taking a step back. They don't. We established as much.
She took another step back. There was too much happening at once. Too many foes and too little time.
Forgive me, he whispered. and then he lunged too quickly for her to move out of the way. He snatched the pistol out of the folds of her sari and took aim. At her. They stared at each other, the two of them against the world, abandoned souls bound by the restless anger in their veins.
"Are you going to kill me?" she asked.
He hesitated, giving her the second she needed, and then she leaped at him, the end of her sari a whisper against her throat. They collided, grappled for the pistol. His hands brushed hers, and her focus shifted. They were back in that room, his lips on hers. Her fangs were sinking into his neck, his hand gripping her thigh. Arthi rammed her shoulder into his chest, but he was bigger, and she was still in shock. He threw her off him, and as Arthi stared down the barrel of the gun, she thought, perhaps, that Laith might not shoot her. She saw it on his face. They were back at that abandoned warehouse again, where she had saved his life before he had saved hers. But then, around her, the fighting and screams began anew. The men weren't curling up in pain anymore. Penn was there, here, shielding her and going for Laith's throat in the same instant. 56. Jin. Jin thought he heard a gunshot. He knew the sound of that pistol and felt a terrible sinking, wrenching, knowing. Calibor. Arthi. His other half in this world of destruction. She would never, ever fire it herself. Not when they knew what it was capable of. He ran for her, stumbling over pools of blood and wayward limbs, journals soaked red and shining pens. He pushed past a pair of the ram's men, swerving away from their attacks, and finally spotted the shimmer of Arthi's sari in the fray. "Don't die, don't die, don't die." He could lose Spindrift 1,000 times, but he could never lose his sister. Jin stopped. The ram stood in his path, and Jin knew with sinking clarity that his end was near. She cocked a revolver, small and dainty, and fired. 57. Arthi. Arthi was on her knees, the floor's cold seeping through the thin silk of her sari. Around her, the carnage continued. Penn's head was in her lap. There was a bullet hole right above his left breast pocket, for Calibor was no ordinary pistol. Still, Penn did not bleed. He did not shake. He did not gasp out a breath. She had brought death to his doorstep, and he was looking up at her as if she'd saved him. His eyes were full of love, and Arthi, after all she had done, loathed herself a little more because of it. "Do not mourn. I lived an eternity and more on this earth."
"We can fix this,"
she said, like a child, like a fool.
"We can be a family together, like you promised."
For years after running away from his home, she wondered what it would have been like if she had stayed. Would she have met Jin? Would she have made good on her anger in open Spindrift? She would have had a father. A family. "Family isn't who we live with, but those we would die for." Penn lifted his hand to her hair, and Arthi couldn't understand how someone so big, so powerful, so ancient could do this. Die. Then he curled her trembling hand into a fist and tucked it against his cold, unbeating heart. "Stay brave, little lion." She didn't want to be brave. She didn't want to keep fighting. The damask curtains fluttered in Laith's wake, a purple hyacinth bright in the fray. "I'm sorry," the flower meant. Arthi threw herself to her feet, just as Flick screamed. 58. Jin. The ram's bullet struck his heart. Jin stumbled, fell. One knee hit the cold, hard floor, then the other. He had long wondered what death would feel like.
He had lived surrounded by it. Weekends in the morgue with his parents and their research. Those harrowing minutes when he'd looked for them in their burning house. Then life with the girl who'd pulled him out of the rubble. Jin didn't know if Arthi was bleeding out somewhere in this hall, just like he was. He didn't know if she was aware of how much he appreciated her, loved her. He blinked groggily, because his eyelids weighed more than a barrel of gunpowder. He saw the Ram's men fall one by one at the hands of vampires he didn't know, joining the reporters who had come here for the truth. And then he saw the Ram herself inching away, disappearing before anyone could stop her. Matea's shadow fell over him. Jin, it's fatal. Let me... Jin knew what he was going to suggest, what he had to offer. He thought he nodded. But then he was alone again, and another pair of footsteps skidded toward him. Flick. She wasn't crying for him, was she? She didn't like him that much. She had kissed him. Beautifully. Jin found himself laughing. It made the pain sharper, colder. He liked it. At least he was going to die happy. Jin, she was saying, over and over. And then she was moving aside. In her place was the girl who had stepped between him and death's scythe again and again and again. She was alive. Of course she was alive. She was Arthi Casimir. She never needed saving. At last, he murmured. He still had so much more to do. Find his parents, rebuild Spindrift, love a girl who had sunshine curls and pastel berets. But he knew Arthi would track them down and do the tea room justice, and Flick would find someone else to love her. No, Arthi said fiercely, thickly, but not even she could stop this. No, Jin, look sharp. Jin felt his eyes flutter shut. He heard voices shouting, arguing, fading away. He was fading away. Then he felt a pain unlike any other, as if the life was being sucked out of him, as if he was being drained, the blood leaving his body. He thought he was screaming, but he couldn't tell. And then something pressed against his lips, and someone pinched his nose, forcing him to drag a broken breath through his mouth. Metal. Metal flooded his tongue in liquid form. Sweet and tangy and sharp. Blood. And then a whisper. Live, said death in his ear. For me. Jin's eyes flew open to a halo of mauve, a pair of demon eyes. Arthi. There was something wrong with her. There were fangs in her mouth. There was blood in his. And as fire bled through his veins, he thought, impossibly, of coconut. Because that was how denial worked. The brain refused to believe the truth in front of it and tucked it away instead. Jin remembered it now, like a shock. Hidden behind the lavender aster bushes in the front lawn of the Siwang residence, as the last of his life went up in flames, an 11-year-old Jin handed Arthi a coconut. Her eyes took on a faraway look when she saw it, and then she seemed sad. He didn't know her well enough to know that she'd come from the same country as this coconut. He thought she simply didn't know how to open it. And if coconuts made people happy, he owed it to her to make her happy, didn't he? He rose on shaky legs and found the gardener's tools, cracking open the coconut the way Solani coconuts ought to be cracked. Divots hacked into the top, not in half like the fibrous brown ones, and poured it into Arthi's dirty cup. Drink. She stared at him, wanting to say something. If only he'd known she wasn't sad. She was a vampire. If only he'd known she was afraid to drink because she thought vampires only drank blood. Drink. He insisted, rattling the coconut to show her that there was more inside. Her gaze dropped to the vein jumping at his throat. But she took a sip. She blinked down at the cup immediately and took another sip. Then another.
Then she tipped the cup upside down until the very last drop disappeared in her throat. Jin hadn't thought anyone could move so quickly. Then again, he didn't know what she was. He didn't know he was changing her life by leading her through the unburned side of the kitchen to a barrel full of the same green coconuts. He didn't realize it wasn't because of her love for them that she used her ingenuity to create an icebox to preserve as many of his father's coconuts as they could, until years later, when she found her footing and began importing them herself. "For Spindrift," she would say. "For myself," she never admitted. "I believe a vampire can subsist on coconut," his father had once said. "And not blood?" Jin had asked, eyes wide. That explained the plethora of coconuts scattered in his father's study, some cracked open, half-full glasses littering the room. There was one such glass on the dinner table. It was murky, with little milk-white slivers floating about. Jin's father took a sip. "Only the Solani coconuts seem to do the trick, though they need to have some blood in them for it to work."
"Are you a vampire then, Pa?"
"I think your mother would have sent me back to the grave already, lad," he replied with a laugh, and gave Jin some to try. It was sweet, and somehow made him feel lighter, happier.
"Good, isn't it?
In addition to making excellent weapons, coconuts make you happy."
How could he have been so blind?
It wasn't tea she lived for, but the coconut. He'd only ever seen her drinking coconut water happily. Rarely anything else. When she'd insisted on keeping a batch in reserve, when she'd always asked after the status of its shipments, more than that of the tea. She had never told him a word. "You were right, Father," Jin thought now. "Vampires can subsist on coconut."
"Wake up," came a voice dragging him from the gallows, from that curtain of forever black. "Jin, wake up."
His eyes fluttered open, and he drew away with a hiss. Everything was too bright, too white, and the hunger. Good grief, he was hungry. Starved. Ravenous. Hadn't he just eaten? He slid his tongue along his teeth, a sinking, harrowing feeling in his stomach. Fangs. He had fangs. That hunger wasn't for food, but blood. Arthi sat back on her heels, the folds of her sari in disarray. Her relief was bare on her face, but she didn't smile. Because she knew him. She knew he was not happy with the secrets she'd kept. She looked smaller, frailer, broken. She stumbled and righted herself. He didn't know what to say, and so he watched as Arthi threw the drape of her sari back over her shoulder, a fan of red and crimson and blood. And then she was gone.
59. Arthi.
Arthi liked to think that she had a heart made of ice, but ice was like glass. One fall, and it shattered. She didn't want to leave Jin. Not now. But she had to move. She paused to look at Pen one last time. The other vampires stayed away. How could they not, when they'd seen the abomination of a weapon that had rendered Pen dead within moments? She took his Ethereum marker and the revolver from his pocket. It was gold, as dignified as he was. And then she ran, the doors of the Ethereum's meeting hall thudding closed behind her. She knew what she looked like to anyone who saw her on the street. A girl racing through the dark, a sari slipping from her shoulder, blood-soaked hands gripping a gun, eyes wild as the night had been. But Nimble Street wasn't far from here. When she tried the door to Laith's apartment, she wasn't surprised to find it unlocked. He was waiting for her in his armchair, the one she'd been seated in on the night they had traded secrets. They had always been destined for this moment. "I told you to leave," she said. "I warned you." "I didn't know what it was capable of," he said. Still holding Calibor. She saw the shock in his eyes.
She believed him, but that wouldn't bring Penn back. That wouldn't undo what had happened. Laith was bleeding from his neck in the same place she had kissed him. If she closed her eyes, they were both on their knees. The truth of what she was bared before him. He laughed and looked down at the pistol.
You understand, don't you? He asked. We're the same, you and I.
He sounded exactly as he always did, the silken thrum of his voice low and lovely.
We will never be the same, she bit out. You're so deluded by your own pride and righteousness that you never stop to wonder if you truly were right.
Are you saying the king didn't send my sister to her death?
Did it ever occur to you that you might be the reason she died? Arthur asked.
Murder darkened his gaze. She recognized that limitlessness, brought on by vengeance. She knew it because it lived in her bones. It was why she was drawn to him, why she'd let him so close to the cage of her heart. But she was like him. And in that, she saw her flaw. She saw herself mired in a past that wasn't driving her forward, but holding her back. She had thought herself feral when he was the animal. You joined that voyage when you were ill, when you knew she would be in close contact with you, when you knew that medical care would be lacking on a ship that was likely one of the first to leave Araria in a long time, Arthi said. You made her sick. She would have been fine if you had seen her potential, rather than lying to yourself that she needed saving. Get behind me. Those words had troubled her since he'd spoken them in the Ethereum. She had thought it was because he had shown care for her when she was moments from betraying him. But that wasn't it. He had always doubted her. He had tried to teach her how to leap across the sky. He had tried to put her behind him. He had all but forced her to drink from him when she had made her reluctance known. Even that kitten of yours. You saw her toying with a snake, not cowering from one, but thought she needed saving too. Do not try to make assumptions about my existence, Laith said coldly. He cocked Calibor. She drew Penn's gold revolver. Oh, these aren't assumptions, Saint. Now put that down. He raised his arm. I truly did grow fond of you, Arthi. Says the pistol aimed at my heart, she replied, brushing her thumb along the hammer of the revolver. She hadn't checked to see how many bullets were in its cylinder. She'd never fired one before, but she'd seen Jin use his enough times to know how it worked. You're ludicrous. He smiled that smile full of secrets. You would know. A shot rang out. Laith fell back into the armchair, surprise gasping out of him. Blood bloomed in the shimmering white of his robes, petals unfurling in crimson. It called to her, but Arthi didn't feel right. She was numb and cold, empty. He had killed, and she had done the same. No, she felt worse than that. The front of her sari was wet. Arthi looked down. Blood dripped onto the floorboards by her feet. The gold revolver fell. Pain started pulsing through her. There was a hole in her heart. The blood she had taken from him spilled from her chest. And she wanted, impossibly, to laugh at the irony of it all. And then Arthi Casimir collapsed.
60. The Wolf.
The Wolf of White Roaring knew what the world saw when they looked at Arthi Casimir. Driftwood washed up on a faraway land, lone and assuming. They couldn't have been more wrong. She was forged of shrapnel words and gunmetal bones, an enigma wrapped in tailored armor and violet-grey curls. She was color in his world that had begun to bleed black and white. Half vampire, half human. More like he once was than any other soul to have crossed his path. The ram had nearly taken her from him, just as the ram had taken everything else. he found her bleeding in an apartment on Nimble Street. "She struck the match," she whispered, an oath in her voice as death came for her, swift as a tempest. He should never have left her alone. "Now we'll burn her to the ground," he swore. Then the wolf of white roaring scooped her into his arms and took her away. Continue listening for an exclusive conversation with the author, Hafsa Faisal.
Ah, you've made it.
We've been waiting for you.
Indeed, we have. Hi, I'm Hafsa Faisal, and I'm the author of A Tempest of Tea, and I hope you enjoyed the read. Betrayal, destruction, and all. I'm excited to be joined by my husband, Casey, today, where we will be discussing the characters, the story, and a little bit about my writing process. Be warned, there will be spoilers, but it's a good thing you've already read the book.
Okay, so since we're coming off of the end of your book, I'm sure I'm going to ask a initial question that many of your readers probably have, which is, how dare you with that cliffhanger? Like, that was just mean. Why did you do that?
I have no answer. I just felt like it. I enjoy the suffering.
Yeah, so I've been to a couple of your talks and I've listened to a lot of your things even before we got married, unbeknownst to you maybe. But one of the things you say is you love to make your readers suffer.
I do.
Why is that?
That's not a question I can answer. I get immense satisfaction out of this. I enjoy it.
So selfishly. So the end of the book was just selfish for you. Okay.
Well, I like making my characters suffer. So if the readers suffer too, that means they are enjoying it to some degree.
That's true. You have to associate with them to some degree for that. Now, with A Tempest of Tea, it's like surrounding, you know, the tea house is a major part of Arthi's life and sort of what roots her down to this new country that she's found herself in. Now, why did you decide to go with tea rather than coffee, which is much superior?
I feel like this whole like conversation is going to be very biased, but tea is the more superior drink. When you see tea displayed, you always see fancy teapots, fancy teacups, like a whole nice display.
It's all about the cups and the pots, not about the actual tea, though.
It is about the tea, too.
With nice coffee, you just have nice coffee.
Yeah, which you just have in, like, disposable cups versus tea. It demands
you got me there.
Nice presentation because it is such an elegant drink.
It's true. It is true. Especially talking about there where it's like you set time out of your day to go to it. And I definitely liked the aspect of being able to talk about how it's like a meeting area. So you have a lot of different people from all walks. And then tying that into the entire vampire aspect too, how you have like, you know, the regular citizens in the day and the vampires at night. Now, with the entire book being a heist, and this is your first heist that you've written, how did you find that a different process than We Hunt the Flame, We Free the Stars?
It was difficult. I am not an outliner in general. I just cannot handle outlining and planning ahead of time. I like to wing it, but with a heist, it required a lot more planning in advance because I need everything to play out a certain way. And there was always that, need to strike a balance between having your characters discuss what they're going to be going through in the heist beforehand and then having them go through whatever it is like in real time. So giving enough information here, having enough information there, and not doubling and not like repeating information again and again. So that required a lot of planning, but at the same time, when I do outline and plan ahead of time, it kind of messes me up. And I guess it sucks the creativity and the excitement out of creating pretty much. So for this heist, I guess in general, my writing process is more like, I guess, organized chaos where I have to have all these disparate thoughts written all over the place in a Gmail draft and in my notes app or on a scrap of paper. And then I'll have to like go through the extra work of figuring out what I left where. Mm-hmm. And that just works. Whereas if I had everything in a very neat list or a neat document, it would just be boring for me because, hey, the work's already done. Why go through it again?
Yeah, you know, it simplifies the process by making it more demanding. So with the book itself and that ending where there's so much happening at one time and it's sort of like the entire book comes to a culmination of just bad things happening to everyone, basically. Who would you say lost the most in that entire event?
Yeah, everyone did suffer a good deal. Everyone in that book. But the greatest tragedy of this story, and again, this is a spoiler, is Jin not being able to eat pastries anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is unfortunate.
It is. It is. I can't imagine not being able to do that anymore.
Yeah, not tasting pastries.
No.
COVID vibes. Now with that, how do you think that, do you think that's something that he would try to replace in a future? Or is that like, he's just going to try to make it work?
I see you're doing the work for the readers where you're trying to get as much as you can out of me about the second book when it's too early and I'm still deciding that myself. I feel like he'll have other outlets to enjoy what he loved.
I tried, everyone. I tried. Okay. So colonialism is a major part of the story as well, along with tea. Now, what made you want to focus on that and be the major topic that you wanted covered?
I did not go into writing the book with the idea of tackling colonialism. I wanted to write a dapper book because I really like the aesthetic of that. And I feel like a lot of my books start off with wanting to write a certain aesthetic. But anyway, I wanted to write that whole dapper setting. I loved Peaky Blinders, and somehow vampires made its way into the book. And then as Aarti stepped onto the page and I started shaping her into who she is, she was just very angry. And I guess once I started asking the question of why she's angry, why is she the way that she is, and why is she so headstrong and all of that, it was pretty obvious that I could not write a setting such as that without also tackling colonialism in some form.
Mm-hmm. Now, on that same topic, you're very talented at essentially writing pieces of yourself into your books.
Thank you.
I think that's why a lot of people are able to relate to them, because they also see themselves in the different characters. Now, with A Tempest being more angry vibe than We Hunt the Flame was, and I feel like there's more characters in general sharing different POVs. So who do you find yourself more closely related to in the book?
In A Tempest of Tea?
In A Tempest of Tea.
Yeah, I think there's definitely pieces of me in each of the characters, but I definitely feel like Aarti is more me than any of the other characters, which I found in We Hunt the Flame too, where I was connected to Zephira and then Nasir. And so anytime there's a POV character, or the main character, I'm usually able to relate to them much more than any of the other characters in the book. And with Aarti, it's her being Sri Lankan, which I can relate to, and her anger at colonialism just kept increasing the more I started researching and the more I realized that so much of the history that we know was rewritten by the colonizer. And I just cannot stand the erasure of history like that. It was just extra horrible to me, extra evil. And I think that so the way I felt about things seeped into Aarti and how she felt and wanting to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, with Aarti, you know, sort of evolving as the story goes on and discovering, you know, what it's like to open up your family to newer people, since she just had Jin for the majority of her adult life anyway, do you feel that towards the end, Spindrift was sort of a lesser part of what she was actually being motivated by, and it was more what Spindrift represents? Because I feel like at the beginning, it was like she was sort of fixated on the building itself. Mm-hmm. But when it gets to the end of the book, it's almost like what she's able to do with the building and what it means.
Yeah, and I think that was addressed at the very beginning of the book too, in like Jin's first chapter, where he said that Aarti will always deny that this place is more than a tea room. But mm-hmm. it definitely is more than that, where it was creating opportunities and saving so many of these little kids' lives, including their own, because they had nothing besides that. And for Arthi, she kept deluding herself by saying that, you know, transactions make everything easy and there's nothing beyond this besides me making money and a name for myself here.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely has more of more meaning to her and more of a connection to her than she likes to admit. And I feel like that is part of her arc, where she's coming to realize that I actually feel things besides anger.
Yeah. Now, on that journey of, you know, discovery and overcoming the walls that she kind of puts up to the world, out of everything that happens to her in the book, what do you think is like one of the main things that sort of turned her in that arc?
I'm not sure. It could be losing Spindrift, or it could be, well, actually getting to the point where she felt comfortable losing Spindrift, because mm-hmm. she knew it was inevitable after a certain point.
Yeah.
Because it was making that decision to help Penn and what he wanted to accomplish versus taking that ledger just to use it as essentially another transaction to save Spindrift.
Yeah.
Where she needed to make that decision, and she made that pretty quickly, because I guess at that point she had finally started to see her crew as a family.
Mm-hmm.
Or she always did, but it was just realizing that.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's always a big difference too, where you might know something subconsciously, but realizing it is also a more powerful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It definitely seems to be a shift from feeling like she's in charge of the people rather than feeling like, you know, it's sort of a mutual reliance upon each other.
Mm.
I noticed that more at the end, where at the beginning, it's kind of like she's telling everyone what to do. She's going around calling all of the shots. But then at the end, it's like, I actually care about these people and need their input and what's best for them and all of these things, especially when it comes to Flick and her mom. Spoiler, too late. Flick and her mom, and sort of opening that door. Now, onto lighter notes. In the next book, will Mateo's shirt find buttons?
They were never missing buttons. That's just the style of his shirt. You sound like you're a little threatened by that.
Oh, I'm not threatened.
Okay.
I guess in the same vein, out of all of these, like, you know, what would you call them? I guess out of all of the love interests in the book, now, which one or all of them were, I guess, modeled after me?
Are you telling me or asking me here?
Because it might be a little bit of both. I mean, depends on if you want a latte later.
Oh, I see. Well, see, I'm still camp tea, so you can keep your latte.
I'll regret that later.
But I started writing A Tempest of Tea before you, and I did realize that while I was explaining Mateo to you at a very early point in our relationship, he did sound a lot like you. So I guess yes is my answer.
Yes.
All of them.
Okay.
Maybe.
It's more than I deserve. Thank you. Okay. What would Arthi's favorite tea be?
So Jin says it best in the book, but Arthi likes things clean cut and simple, but done very well. So a very good English breakfast tea, which sounds very simple, but as someone who drinks tea wherever she goes, it is so hard to find a good one.
It is very hard, or it'll be like too watery, you know?
Yeah.
So I appreciate the little repartee you had calling out bad tea in the book, because that's, I feel like, an unaddressed topic in our society.
It is, because you might find good tea, but it also has to be made well.
Yeah, that's definitely a major part of it.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of twists in the book, and some of them come out of nowhere, and some of them, you know, you kind of try to pick apart along the way. What do you think was your favorite one to write? And did it come to you like early on, or was it something that just sort of unfolded as you were writing it?
I don't usually plan my endings, but when I started writing the book, I knew that I wanted it to end in a very explosive manner. So I did know how the story would end. And I did know that Arthi, again, spoilers, again, I knew that Arthi being a vampire would be a twist that a lot of people saw coming.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would expect it, because usually when there's a vampire book, one of the characters is a vampire and they just don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. But so I was kind of playing off of that so that I could hide some of my other twists.
Yeah.
So it would read like, oh, the author is trying to be really, really secretive here about, with this twist, but I see it coming. And having readers focus on that twist so that I could have these other ones creep in without being noticed. But I don't know if I planned for all of them. I definitely planned for the ending and then Arthi being a vampire. But my favorite twists are the ones that I don't see coming either. And that's another reason why I don't like outlining too much.
Mm-hmm. So you feel like having that freedom of motion with your creative process kind of opens you up to more in that regard.
Yeah, I think letting the characters carry the story, which before I became a writer, when an author would say, I started writing this character and then they just took the story in an entirely different direction, I would be like, how? You're the writer. And then when I started writing my debut, We Hunt the Flame, it was a lot different. I started with Saphira and I started with these other characters, and slowly it just became their story and I was just the one writing it down, pretty much. And that happened in A Tempest of Tea too.
Mm-hmm. We love. Now, a lot of the characters have, you have incredible world building and sort of, I guess, addressing how each character sees it differently. So with Jin, you get a lot of his, you know, past family trauma kind of leaching into how he deals with the world, but he's also more on the brighter side of things, whereas Arthi is sort of cynical throughout it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Jin being the sort of happy-go-lucky one, and then meeting Flick, who is also like even more happy-go-lucky in those senses, how do you think that she will be affected as far as that relationship is concerned? Because it seems like Jin went through a lot prior to meeting Flick, and then now that he met Flick, she's gone through a lot. Do you think that he's sort of like predisposed to be able to help her since he's already helped Arthi?
Yeah, I think we have Arthi at one end and Flick at the other end, and Jin is sort of in between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So while Jin has been through a lot, he still hasn't, and I don't know if it's because of her association with, I don't know if it's because of Jin's association with Arthi that he hasn't really explored his emotions and why he feels a certain way. I don't think he's fully processed his grief. And that's something he touches on a little bit with Flick, and I think will be explored a lot more in the second book when they might just, I don't know, go through that together.
Mm-hmm.
Because Flick allows herself to feel a lot more than Arthi does. And so she'll pretty much be Jin's therapist and he will be hers, mm-hmm. where they will be able to discuss their feelings and how all of this has affected them, and that this necessarily isn't a bad thing, whereas Arthi sees everything as a bad thing.
Naturally. She's trying to come around, though.
She is.
I mean, that ending didn't really help her with that, but...
Yeah. I definitely think the second book will be a place of healing for all of them. Maybe.
Good.
While suffering a lot more.
Yeah, have to add the suffering. I mean, what else would you write it for? So on the subject of Jin and Flick, what would their ideal date night look like?
Oh, it would definitely be related to food.
Mm-hmm.
If this was pre everything that happens in the book, they would definitely have a date at Spindrift, because Jin loves tea and pastries and Flick just loves observing other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the perfect place to do that. So Spindrift or another tea room, or if Jin feels like, you know, if he feels too shy to take her to the same place that he works at, then a fancy restaurant or something.
Fancy restaurant.
Yeah.
You're saying Spindrift isn't fancy?
It is, but I don't know. What if he feels a certain way?
A place that doesn't serve blood. Oh, but now he'll want that, so I don't know. I mean, it's a 2-for-1. It's Fendrick. Okay. So I guess in the same line with Jin, why did you choose to give him an umbrella of all things?
I don't know. It was cool.
Cool umbrellas, you know, multifaceted.
Yeah.
Block the rain and block other stuff.
Yeah, and then that umbrella has meaning to him because he finds it when he is trying to escape the burning house that pretty much burned down his entire past and who he was before he met Arthi, because one happens right after the other. And so he just finds that umbrella on his way out, and that belonged to his father, who he really looked up to as a role model. And so him keeping that with him and then converting it to a weapon, which means it fits his lifestyle a lot more now, mm-hmm. means he's still keeping that part of him or that piece of his past with him while, I don't know, evolving to meet this new life that he lives in.
Mm-hmm. So even though it's like stationary in his life, he adapts it to where he is at the moment.
Yeah. Keeping a little piece of his past alive through it.
So it's his Calibor.
Yeah, pretty much. And it breaks bones.
Yeah, all good things break bones, you know. So you have multiple POVs in the story. Now, how did you decide who gets one? You just draw them out of a hat or?
No. So Arthi was definitely the first one. And I think that's how I usually start my stories, where I take a lot of time figuring out who my main character will be. Or I start writing them. They just step onto the page and then it's finding someone who balances them well. So with Arthi being so cynical and dark and pretty much grumpy, she needed someone a lot brighter by her side to balance that out, or that story would be very dreary and dark. And Jin was the perfect one to do that. And with these two being in a very cutthroat part of the city, and, you know, the slums and just the darker, harsher side of that capital city, I wanted someone to balance that out. And so that's how Flick came in to be our third point of view.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
I think it's always just finding that who balances who and how, you know, I could describe the world from more angles and have more insight into the plot. Because sometimes one of them sees it differently than the other. The same aspect is just seen differently from everyone's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, with Arthi, I guess her main driver is Spindrift. Laith is, you know, coming from a new area with his, I guess, untold motive as far as Arthi is concerned. Now, she was skeptical of him getting there in the beginning, but she kind of opened up to him as the story went on. Now, do you think that her doing that was beneficial or sort of worked against her when it came to her overall arc? Like, did it help her open up to everyone else as well? Or do you think that would make her shut down more once she realizes he kind of betrayed her?
Arthi will definitely think twice, I think. She will have to have like a little moment where she thinks about how I opened up to someone and that created all of this. Like, I opened up to him and he turned out to be horrible and he turned out to be using me. And I think the fact that she is still surrounded by other people that love her might dampen that a little bit. She won't shut down as much as she thinks she will because she has a good support group.
Mm-hmm.
He did give her a lot of insight into herself. So he might have been a horrible person, but there's still a lot that to him that she can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she can see his side of things, even if he did some horrible things to her.
Yeah, I feel like it's easy to look at the actions committed and the things done and just kind of cover it with a paintbrush and say, oh yeah, he's horrible. But something Arthi seems to do is be more empathetic than she would let on. So she understands like where he's coming from, what he's doing. She knows what it's like to lose and what it's like to want to get all of that back. So I can kind of see her understanding it, but also being able to isolate it and see it as like, that's just him. Now, I guess bringing it more to your side of things, with Arthi having Spindrift, you know, Zephira having magic, do you see yourself, I guess, aligning more with Zephira or Arthi?
I don't know. When I wrote We Hunt the Flame, I could relate to Zephira a lot in the sense that she is one girl pretending to be something she's not and providing for her family and everyone that she can, knowing that she will get nothing in return for it,
mm-hmm.
which I could relate to a lot because of my own life. And so when I started writing A Tempest of Tea, I remember discussing it with a friend, and I told her, I feel like I've written all of myself into We Hunt the Flame and We Free the Stars, and now with this new book, you know, being set in the cutthroat streets of Atenea, I just don't think I can relate to them at all. And she was like, what do you mean? Arthi started from nothing, created a business out of nothing, and feels like she has no one to rely on and that she's doing this all on her own, even when she has people around her. And I could definitely relate to that a lot too, because I too started a business from nothing and I felt like I was doing everything on my own when I did have my sisters as a huge support group, and now you. But I think I will always be able to relate to my main characters. And though I felt like I couldn't relate to Arthi, there's a lot to her that I did not find in Zephira, and a lot in Zephira that I will not find in Arthi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of answered my next question, which was going to be like, what do you see as your Spindrift?
This is a very difficult question. I guess that's fully understanding what Arthi sees as her Spindrift, or mm-hmm. what Arthi sees Spindrift as, because
and it varies by what version or
of
what
her, yeah.
area of the book, you know.
True.
But as with all things, you evolve in life, so it would be something that also evolves with you.
I don't know. It could be my creativity.
Mm-hmm.
That is important to me, and sometimes I see that as a curse. And something that needs to be burned down and brought back. And with the right people, that creativity will have deeper meaning and mean more to me if I'm surrounded by the right people.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for Arthi, if without the crew, Spindrift will be nothing to her. And she doesn't fully realize that at the time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Why are we discussing such deep questions?
That's what I'm here for. Plus, I'm out of my pre-planned questions.
So you have
all
to
I have is
deeper.
What's in my heart. Yeah, got to go deep. Now, but we can get back to the story if you prefer. So in the book itself, I know you've mentioned a lot of times sort of leaving yourself cookies to write along the way, where you have your favorite parts that you look forward to writing and you sort of get to it. What do you think your favorite part of writing was in A Tempest of Tea?
I definitely liked writing their backstories, because I started off the stories with, oh, hey, all these horrible things happened to me as a kid. And so finally reaching the point where I let them unleash everything. Like, Arthi got to talk about what she went through, and Jin got to talk about what he went through. And so that was very satisfying to finally be able to write that scene and have it like fit into place like a really satisfying puzzle. So the backstories were fun to write, and also the emotional beats. I always enjoy those, whether that is a romantic one or something more plot related, where just a betrayal or meeting someone from your past, which is Arthi and Penn. But yeah.
Okay. I guess something that's kind of unaddressed in the book is that I'm curious about. How do you think the Ram views Arthi?
It was unaddressed because I don't know either, Casey.
You just wrote the character. I don't know what's in their head.
I think just like Arthi sees bits of herself in the Ram definitely sees bits of herself in Arthi. And one of the reasons why she tears Spindrift down is definitely because she feels threatened by Arthi. And you're usually threatened by someone who you see as like a foe who is on your level. And the Ram is a woman who had to build all of this up from nothing and knows what it's like to run a business and have to hold your own head in a man's world. And so she sees Arthi doing that same thing, and I can see her being threatened by Arthi and maybe even respecting her a little bit. But of course, that will all be discussed more in Tempest 2, mm-hmm. the sequel.
The sequel. Okay. Now, the Ram, you know, pivotal bad guy in the entire book. Who do you think would be the lesser evil in the book?
Like
of all the characters, would you call Laith a bad guy from the start, or do you think he just became one, or how do you think that would?
I think Laith was always Arthi's adversary. That doesn't necessarily mean he was a villain, but he was always her foil in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes a secondary villain, but Arthi always saw him as such from the very beginning. That's why she planned on turning him in at the Aetherium and double-crossing him before he could do that to her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was always a secondary villain. And of course, Arthi herself is a villain to herself because she has to accept who she is in order to continue. And it was like coming to terms with who she is, and which is part of her arc, of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, with Penn dying, and he's kind of, you know, he's addressed in the book, but not to the degree that, you know, he was in Arthi's life. So we're kind of given the idea of how much he meant to her, but we don't like fully know, I guess. Now, do you feel like as you wrote the story, did you think he had to die in order for Arthi to move forward in life?
I would have to. I'm still in the very early stages of drafting the sequel, and I haven't really explored how his death affected Arthi, because he was a very small part of her life. He was only in her life for a few months. But I remember writing a bonus scene for after I finished the book, and his words just popped up into her mind, and she was thinking about how someone who was in my life for so short a time, how is he having this effect on me? Because she had her parents, and they were loving parents and all of that. But once they passed away, she became something that she was not when she had those parents. And so Penn definitely took on a father figure role for her. Even if it was for a very short while, he still had a great impact on her life. And I think him resurfacing in her life also made a big impact. And then only to die so quickly after, and being a vampire. So that was like totally unexpected for her and for the rest of the crew. It definitely made an impact, and I think we'll be seeing that in the sequel.
Very good, very good. Now, I had another question, and I just lost it.
Oh, no.
Now, with Arthi and going through all of these horrible circumstances, and it kind of came out of nowhere to her, where she was just, you know, happily abiding in the world that she essentially created for herself after losing everything. Do you think that had none of this happened and she just kept running Spindrift, would that be enough for her? Or would that have been enough for her?
I don't see it being enough for her. No. She was running it for several years, but I think after a certain point, she might have created more troubles for herself, or Spindrift just would be one step in her empire. She would have kept going, adding more features to it. I don't know. I guess we'll never know.
Branching
or
out.
Or we might know at the end of the book. We'll see.
Franchise.
Spindrift the franchise.
Now, I guess in moving towards the closeout, so with you relating to Arthi and, you know, being self-made essentially with assistance and all, for the people that relate to Arthi and maybe come from parents who immigrated or are having to bring themselves up from bad situations, what is something that you would tell them?
It is a longer process than you might think, and it will be frustrating and it will be difficult and you might want to give up, but like Arthi, just do not do that. Arthi just does not see giving up as an option. And I think that's why she's able to keep persevering. And I think that's key with almost anything. Even when I started to pursue getting published, I realized that there was a lot of authors who had degrees or had prior experience with writing. But for me, that just wasn't an option. And I realized that perseverance was all it took, that I had to just keep trying and trying, and knowing that everything that I went through would help me a lot more when I finally found that success, which is very important to Arthi, where she keeps powering through. And I think also it's very important to seek help from your support circle and realizing that they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Very good. Well said.
I try. Thank you. Well, thank you all for listening. I had a good time discussing this with you.
As did I.
You're a good interview partner, I guess.
I do my best, trying to keep up.
Well, yeah, I hope you all enjoyed A Tempest of Tea, and I can't wait to share the sequel with you.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this production of A Tempest of Tea, a Macmillan audio production from Farrar, Straus and Giro Books for Younger Readers Audio. Production supervised by Chloe Nossan. Text copyright 2024 by Hafsa Faisal. Production copyright 2024 by Macmillan Publishers International Limited. All rights reserved. For more information about Macmillan audiobooks, please visit macmillanaudio.com.